This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio EcoShock, it's permaculture, the big picture, and solutions for climate change. There's no time for a big introduction. It's a packed show. We're just going to dive right in with the 15th Annual International Permaculture Convergence in London, September 9th, 2015. You'll get a cool talk by Albert Bates from the farm in Tennessee. Then Albert interviews Transition Town's founder Rob Hopkins for Radio EcoShock. We wrap up with the longtime Australian permaculturalist Rosemary Murrow, who tells us Western permies are the minority compared to the big movements in East Asia, India, Africa, and the Pacific Islands. If you don't know what permaculture is when we start, you will by the end of this intensive radio feature. Here is Albert Bates in London.
Welcome to the climate change session. As you will probably agree, it's very important to highlight and showcase permaculture and what it's doing in climate change mitigation. We had quite a lot of offers for this session. We chose three very good presentations. First of all, we've got Albert Bates, former president of the Global Eco-Village Network and currently head of their NGO delegation at the UN Climate Talks in Paris this December, holding there a plenary event called Eco-Villages 10,001 Solutions for Climate Change. Albert has worked for 40 years in the field of integrated development and has trained people from more than 60 countries. He is also the author of numerous books on energy, environment and history, The Biochar Solution, Financial Collapse Survival Guide, and most recently, Pour Evian on Your Radishes. Please welcome Alex.
Okay. You know, this topic is a bit daunting. Are there any hedge fund managers in the room? If you don't want to say, it's okay. You know, if you're a hedge fund manager, right about now, you're pretty worried about what's a safety place for your fund. What should you be putting hedge on? And you're worried about silver and gold. They're manipulated. Bitcoin, the yuan, renminbi, all manipulated. We know from the LIBOR scandal, all that stuff is very ephemeral. Commercial real estate in London, anyone? So there are no longer any safe havens. And these are manipulated by kleptocrats at best, CIA and MI6 at worst. Second homes on private island might look good now, but what about in 5 years? And here's, you know, a safe haven I'm going to give you. This is what this is about. If you read that it was about eco-villages, yes, sort of. That's a subset of the larger picture. Eco-villages that are carbon negative, that continuously build value, that have social worth that exceeds any currency worth. If you're interested either as an investor or designer, by all means, let's talk. I came to this by going through the carbon cycle and looking at sources and sinks and seeing what are our points of intervention. And you need to work on both sides of the ledger. If you're going to change the dynamic, reverse climate change, get us back to a pre-Anthropocene concentration in the atmosphere and the oceans, there's really only one sink that you have available to you, and that's the soil. It's the ground. It's what's under our feet. And that's the one that we can most safely work with. The tools that we've come to use are these available tools on the sink side. You're not going to like geoengineering. You can't afford it. It won't work. But these things work, and they can scale quickly. And when I use the term permafuels down here, I mean local, socially responsive, ecologically restorative, waste-to-energy renewable systems with carbon capture and sequestration. Here's an example. This is a beaner. It's a camping stove. This is the beaner.
Can you buy one?
Yeah, it's 20 euros. It comes from Italy. It's worldstove.com. You take this on your backpack. It's called a beaner because you can put a carabiner through this hole, stick it on your belt or your backpack. You take it camping with you. You get to your campsite. You start looking around for some pine needles or pine cones or cardboard or scrap wood or different kinds of things out of the dump. You look for a can in the dump. Any can will do. It doesn't matter whether you're in India or the Philippines or South Africa, all cans are the same dimension. And so it's actually geared to fit exactly into this space. Poke a few holes at the bottom, drop your material inside, drop a lit match in, Takes a few minutes to get going. You're going to get a little bit of smoke at first, a yellow flame. But as it gets going, it heats up. The metal heats up. And so as it does, it forces the gases out of the biomass. The gases travel up the inside of the jacket because of the holes I punched at the bottom. As they travel up, they find that there's nowhere to exit, so they enter back in at these ports on the top, these little venturis. And as they come through, they cross over the flame. And as they cross over the flame, they ignite. So now you have this blue mandala, like looking down at a gas range. And there's no smoke because it's cut off oxidation. It's cut off the oxygen flow below. And it's becoming pyrolysis, absence of oxygen, heating the biomass, turning it into gas, burning the gas. All you're getting is a little water vapor coming off the top. It doesn't create any ash. You can cook on the stove like this with one load for about 90 minutes because it's about 30% more efficient. So you've made your Norse soup mix or your spaghetti, and now you're done, and you quench the fire, and you take out what's left, which is hard carbon, biochar, and you put it in the soil. You just had a carbon-negative camping experience. You've sequestered your footprint. Now, there are models of this. The BioLite I didn't bring, but it's a model that produces electricity, so you can charge your laptop or you can charge your cell phone. If you're using GPS on your phone or you have an Apple Watch and you want to charge that overnight while you're camping, you can do it because you've got a little thermocouple that while you're cooking your dinner, it's making biochar and it's giving you back electricity. This is a model that can scale. There are now for sale over-the-counter versions of this that do 100 kilowatts, and they produce biochar for gardens or for other uses, which I'll go through a little. So this is something I showed in the Cuba slideshow for those of you who were there. The idea in both Jordan and Cuba, I talked about cool food. Making cool products and branding them as net carbon sequestering. For me, cool is a stickier meme than carbon negative or carbon minus. You have to think about the neurolinguistic patterning and how our reptilian brains respond to tribal cues, right? We're seekers of tribeness amongst our mates, right? This is our evolutionary track, that we are herd animals. And so we look for cool things. We're cool hunters, all of us, and cool means. So what we're looking for here is something like cool food that's made putting the biochar at the base of the cacao tree, taking the cacao pods and turning them into biochar, a full cycling. And so you can then brand it as a cool food, like charcoalit. I don't know if Craig Sams is here, but here's an idea for you. Cool feed. So now we've learned that the biochar as an alimentary additive has beneficial effects, particularly for farm animals. You can reduce the need for antibiotics. You can greatly drop the supply of antibiotics. And that actually has added impacts in that we're getting some feedback. This is one reason that Big Pharma is mounting an anti-biochar campaign, just like the fake tobacco studies in the 1950s. Their business model depends on selling you more antibiotics, and this is a business model that's going the opposite direction. Cool buildings. So biochar paints and plasters, geotextiles, living roofs. We're actually finding by putting biochar into a clay render or lime render that it works the same way a charcoal filter on a cigarette works. It cleans the air in the room. It takes out pollen and mold spores. This is huge in many parts of the world. If you have hay fever, you can appreciate this. So it's biobiology. It's room air conditioning, room cleaning of the air, cleaning sick buildings by putting a simple paint that has a charcoal core to it. And it can be several layers deep, and it still works if the wall breathes at all. And you can think also about using the biochar in sequence. Your cob building that you built for the course falls apart after a few years, or you're not going to need it anymore, and you move it. Take that and put that in the garden, and now what have you got? The biochar is going back into the garden. Or it can go onto a living roof, and now you're sequestering carbon in a couple different ways. We're just beginning to tap what some of the things that biochar can do. There's weird science everywhere. Who knew that it can block Wi-Fi or infrared signals? But they're using it now in gully suits for snipers because it blocks your IR signature. And you also have the potential for, if you're worried about the Faraday box effect of the building that you live in, why not plaster it with biochar? You won't get very good Wi-Fi reception, but you know, you have a comfortable night's sleep with no electromagnetic fields. This also plays into the people who have grow rooms in their basement. Avoid detection. So, cool energy. Biochar replacing cathodes in fuel cells to create better storage. And new studies from China about the charge potential of charred banana peels. So you can imagine charging phones and things by having a little pyrolytic converter that can make your own battery. And solar refrigerator in Guatemala that's 10% better, 10 times better at flash cooling with a biochar medium under a glass top, meaning that you can make ice with cardboard and aluminum in anywhere where there's direct sunlight using something like biochar. So I showed this in Cuba, and the idea is of a cascade model, stack functions, multiple yields, and you need to imagine these in the context of whole systems approaches, such as eco-village. The idea that you create, you're doing terra preta formation in everything you do, whether it's building or gardening or energy systems, transportation, and so forth. And you can sequence the material as it goes through the cycle from the time it's harvested. And I take a lot of bamboo and turn it into biochar and can make 3 or 4 wheelbarrow loads in about a half an hour. And then that goes through a compost operation, and actually it helps the compost. It speeds up the compost. I can add it as a very fine powder to compost teas, and it goes to the garden. I can have it as a water treatment. It can go from the water treatment use to be going into conditioner for silage, where it actually reduces the bad ferments in silage and increases the good ferments in silage. And then it's eaten by the cattle over winter, becomes a digestive supplement for the cows. They don't need the antibiotics. It goes into the litter in the barn, and it actually reduces the ammonia smell. And then you go from there as a manure conditioner. It gets hauled away and put into compost. It becomes a soil conditioner. And from the soil amendment, it becomes carbon sequestration, where it's going to stay in the soil because it's recalcitrant carbon. It's a hard crystalline form. It's going to stay there for 1,000 years. It's not going back to become next year's plants. It's in a form that's going to take it from the atmosphere, deprive the atmosphere for a life cycle of considerable length. And then that's actually going to serve the oceans as well, because the oceans are under stress from the atmosphere. So we're hoping to drop the whole thing by putting it all in the soil. I did a study that was in Permaculture Activist, which is now Permaculture Design magazine, and also another one that appeared in Permaculture last year in the UK, that was looking at eco-villages and how much they already are cool, how much they net sequester. And we found that Earth Haven was net sequestering 30% more than its residents' footprints in greenhouse gas emissions from all sources, visitors, travel, businesses, and so forth. If you looked at Ecodorf, Zeven Linden, you got a very substantial net sequestration. Findhorn in Scotland, even with all the visitors, because of the Caledonian reforestation efforts that they do. And the farm, my community, 5 times the footprint is being sequestered each year. And that's primarily from forest. Forest is the big wedge. By putting more trees in and keeping those trees growing, bringing them to maturity, using a lot of forest products, we get cool. So this is about how you get cultural traction. And we live in a world of style. We are herd animals. And you have to ask what attracts people. What are the carrots, not the sticks? We've got plenty of sticks coming out of UN climate conferences and scary headlines in the news. What are the carrots? And permaculture, obviously, can provide a very strong carrot. We can have a much better planet if we follow simple rules. And in the world of style, what attracts people is having something that's neat and got a story behind it, and it's a kind of a fun story to tell your friends, We were doing a permaculture course last week in Iceland, and we were doing a design exercise for a local farmer. And the farmer said there's something he required in our design. He wanted a feature in the design that would be quite interesting. So I said, okay, that's the QI component, right? We want something to be quite interesting. The idea of that came around to us. We're doing a quite interesting company now. It's called ECO2. It's in the pre-launch phase, and it's not dissimilar to what Ethan and the folks at TerraGenesis are doing with regenerative real estate design. It's exactly what International Permaculture Design is planning. I'm a CPO of this company, a chief permaculture officer, which is something every company should have, I feel. And we are open source, easily replicated, but we want to reach out and hire you. We will need lots of more designers to do these projects. We apply community-based plus riparian methodology, holistic management, mob grazing, keyline, biochar, energy capture and storage, alley crops, offset density, reafforestation. It's not a secret formula. It's open source. What we're doing is creating a model, beginning with site surveys, going there, living with the people, visioneering with the stakeholders, acquiring needed expertise as needed, Landsat imaging, legal government liaisons. You know, we want to do plant leaf protein, so we bring in Dave Kennedy. Biochar Bob is on the ground right now. Green Capital. Chris Nesbitt came over from Belize to look at the potentials there for different food foresting, bioenergy and protein cascades. The deliverables for the local community: energy independence at 1/7 of the capital expenditures of photovoltaics or wind. A green school. I don't know how many are familiar with John Hardy and what he's doing in Bali. Roadless wilderness preservation, 95% offset. Investor return of investment in the early going of 20 to 30% APR. Net sequestration of approximately 1,000 megatons of carbon per year. Naturally increasing without further intervention, and eco-villages. Our company is just starting off the first grid eco-village community, working at the scale of a watershed with an underserved, disenfranchised, overexploited base population yearning for empowerment and a better future for their children. We're working at the scale of watershed. Our intended first-year deliverables are generating potable water, 100% waste treatment, biomass to energy, food, biofertilizers, bioproteins, and some other products from 200% carbon-negative integrated microbiorefinery for small-scale production. We can't get any of this accomplished without support from the existing residents, so we ask. We become the community. We work together to design our shared future. Scaling up, we can take this to 10 petagrams, 10 gigatons of carbon per year very quickly, 10 years. Fossil fuels are now 5.6 gigatons per year, so it would erase that by nearly double. If you remove fossil fuels expeditiously, we can talk about getting back to pre-industrial atmospheric greenhouse gas levels by mid to late century, barring a clathrate gun already triggered or some other black swan event already in play. In which event, this is still very much the best way to spend the closing of an epoch. Our job is a garden planet that can support continued evolution of life in all its forms. There are many possible routes that these steps can take. They're not mutually exclusive. This is our showcase project, location undisclosed for the moment while the land is being secured. We're working with the government to set aside a huge amount as national park. It's car-free. Off-grid, but connected. No export capitalism is required. Accessible to sail routes in the Caribbean. A pirate-proof food forest. Mm-hmm. A moderate microclimate. A hedge for the future. And a model for all manner of de-development in the degrowth era. We are recruiting here. Before Petra collapse or Ponzi collapse, we can install CPOs in both large and small firms working in any of these fields. Biomass, food, fertilizer, energy, waste management. Everything is food for something, and the first step is recapturing waste to assign it value. The opposite is also possible, which is to re-inhabit remnant sanctuaries and secure them from exactly those kinds of firms, setting aside nature preserves protected by indigenous eco-villages. In the first case, you redesign businesses to become more resilient by not being rapists, And then second, you simply disappear your culture into the fabric of the forest and become virtually invisible, quietly restoring the pre-Anthropocene climate as nothing out of the normal for you. There will be people who incline towards either of these.
That was permaculture teacher, author, and activist Albert Bates speaking at the 15th Annual International Permaculture Convergence in London, September 9th, 2015. Albert hails from the farm in Tennessee. Find links to his blog and his works in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Next, Albert interviews Transition Towns founder Rob Hopkins for Radio EcoShock.
My name is Rob Hopkins from Transition Network and from the beautiful Devon town of Totnes, which is one of the founding stones of the transition movement.
Great. Well, first off, I just took a tour around Totnes. I went to the Atmos Center and I was totally enamored, not so much by the project. I've seen urban brown space redevelopment kinds of things. What impressed me was the process. Mm. And you've set aside a part of this brownfield site as a museum to the process, even before it's gone very far. And being able to walk through year by year, day by day, you know, who's been to which event, it really shows social permaculture in such an elegant way. That's one of the finer features of having a history, having a way of keeping up. Okay, so a few questions. One is, you've got four children. You hear a lot about climate change. You think about their future. You're tuned in to the latest scientific reports all the time. Surely there must come moments when it seems very dark. How do you think about the future? Do you have hope? And if so, why?
I think like everybody, and I always come back, that thing Paul Hawkins said about if you're not optimist and you haven't read this climate science properly, go back and read it again. And if you're a pessimist, then you haven't spent any time among the movement of people doing something about it. I kind of inhabit that space, and I try not to get attached to whether I'm an optimist or a pessimist, because I don't think there's much value in either, really. You sort of shut down, and it's really a, for me, part of the dice, like AC/DC, you know, part of the energy that drives me is that flipping back and forth between the two things. And, you know, I think we all have to make space for those moments where you think, this is just awful. But then at the same time, you know, I'm in a very kind of privileged position of meeting and visiting lots of transition groups doing phenomenal stuff all over the place. And seeing, you know, I mean, something like the Atmos project that you mentioned for me is an incredible example of taking this to places that's not expected of it. There's a Jean de Buffet, who was a French artist, used to say, art's best moments are when it forgets what it's called. And so for me, permaculture and transition's best moments are when it moves outside what's kind of expected of it, you know? And I loved that. I remember a really key moment for me in 2012 in Totnes was we ran a campaign to stop. You know, we're a town where 80% of our high street is small independent businesses. And that in the UK now is a precious, precious thing. Very few, most places it's the other way around. And for us, that resilience is the foundation that we build the new economy off, not something that's expendable. We have 40 places in our town where you can buy a cup of coffee from an independently owned business. And Costa Coffee, who are a massive, like the British Starbucks, wanted to open an outlet in a big unit at the bottom of the town where all the tourists come. The first place they would come to off the bus, Costa. They recognize it. Great, let's go into Costa. You know, a third of our coffee shops up the high street just die, and that's local families. So we ran a campaign that wasn't really anti-Costa. It was pro what we love about our town and about its culture and why that's so precious. The amazing thing was, you know, I've been since I was 16 involved in campaigning on different things about nuclear and roads building and Iraq war and this, that and the other. Never won anything. I realized at the time, actually, I've spent so many years of my life campaigning and protesting and lost all of them. And actually, and that's my default expectation, is you make a lot of noise and you lose. And a lot of other people's expectation from outside is, people like you make a lot of noise and then you lose everything and everything carries on as it is and that's just fine. And actually, we won the Costa. Costa decided they wouldn't come. And what was really interesting was, firstly, for me, and a lot of us, that experience of, ooh, this is a funny feeling. I'm not used to this. But also other people who were like, who didn't feel that they knew, who wanted a costume, who didn't feel they needed to make a noise about it, because you lot always lose. And all of a sudden, well, we actually quite wanted a costume, actually. And so I guess for me, you know, more and more, I mean, with things like Atmos and with incredible things happening, like, I mean, the Bristol Pound, these big sort of local currency schemes going on. You know, there's now £13 million in this country invested in community energy raised through transition energy companies. Massive kind of impacts now when we're starting to measure them. Actually, we need to start getting used to the feeling of actually doing well at this stuff and winning. And, you know, Marianne Williamson had that thing about, you know, what we feel is our own brilliance or whatever. I think we're at that point, and that sense of this is starting to shift and actually we're starting to win some of these things, for me, is one of the things that helps me overcome those dark moments.
You have a new book that's coming out that captures some of these successes. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, in December in Paris, it's COP21, where all the world leaders come together, hopefully, and reach some sort of agreement that is what we need to see. You know, what we saw in
Copenhagen.
With Copenhagen was that everybody put in all that Copenhagen rubbish, you know, that actually everybody then, when it didn't happen, I mean, it kind of kicked the climate change movement in the knackers for about 4 years. We only just sort of got back up off the floor again in the last couple of years, you know. And where was I?
Copenhagen was a bust.
So for us, actually, we felt that what we needed to do was something that was a celebration. And that kind of said, do you know what? Regardless of what you decide to do, there's something really amazing going on here, and we're going to celebrate that. And you need to hear about that, because actually all over the world, in thousands and thousands of places, people are living in the way that we need to live if we successfully are able to avoid the worst excesses of climate change. And they're having a better time. They're creating jobs. They're pulling their local economies together. They're doing all sorts of amazing things.
Name of the book?
The name of the book is going to be called 21 Transition Stories for COP21. We invited transition groups around the world to send in their stories. We chose 21. They're incredibly diverse, from 15 countries, 39 transition groups. We pulled out lots of really amazing hard data. You know, there's that collectively those stories have saved, have reduced car travel, the distance of driving to the moon and back twice. They're generating enough electricity for 36,000 homes. They've raised £13 million worth of investment into local renewable energy. They're supporting hundreds of farms. I mean, it's really, but also you then get across the message, and that's just the stuff they measured. You know, we look at, often people would come to something like transition, how much carbon has it saved? Well, that's an important question. But nobody really asks, well, how many of our volunteer hours have you generated? We've got 21 stories in there. They've generated 15,000 hours of community engagement. That's 21 stories. You think over the last 10 years, if every transition group had measured the number of volunteer hours it had generated and then put like a monetary value to that, I mean, it's awesome, you know. And so those are the stories that we felt we needed to take to COP, to celebrate, to say, do you know what? You do what you do, but actually, this is phenomenal that this thing is happening and you could be part of it. And so that's what we're doing. So it's going to be called 21 Stories for COP21. It'll be coming out at the beginning of November. There will also be an ebook, and there'll be lots of other stuff that will be designed off the back of that.
Last question. If you had one wish, if you had one thing that a fairy godmother came and gave you for you to help you personally with your work, have any idea what that might be?
Well, I think the first answer to that question is in many ways, I think the fairy godmother already came, because we set up Transition Network. It's an organization of about 12 people. We're in the fortunate position where, I mean, it's hand to mouth, but you know, we are able to have that team of people working there. Incredible. You know, this event here has been pulled together by those 12 people who work together in a way of, with a depth of respect and trust and working that is really phenomenal. So in some ways, my fairy godmother already came. It would be, and again, this is the second one has actually already happened as well, is about communications. Mm. You know, if you look at it, like we have people who are comms professionals who work in organizations whose job is to take an organization that doesn't really do very much and generate it and make it look like they're awesome and they're doing all this fantastic stuff, and actually it's not that great, and they get really disillusioned with, God, I'm having to make this, paint this little thing to be fantastic. I mean, actually comms people come to us and they're like, transition is incredible, look at all these stories, you've got this city doing this, you've got this, you've got this, you've got this. And so, but we've always struggled with the capacity to really get those stories out. So we now have somebody. So the fairy godmother has come twice, and she just started the other day. So we're going into doing this stuff around COP with a brilliant comms professional. And I think that's really going to help. So she's my fairy
godmother. So if she comes the third time, what's the fairy godmother going to bring you that time?
What would she mean the third time? I think she would bring... One of the big challenges we have with projects like Atmos, which in many ways represent the next evolutionary step, I think, for transition, which is about, okay, if we're serious about this, if you bring an entrepreneur's brain to these challenges, how do they look at this stuff? You know, if you, and is it possible that a transition group that's just meeting on its Wednesday evenings once a month, once it's got the kids to bed, is going to be able to produce the change on the scale we need? And so the thing with Atmos is about, we need to own assets as a community, we need to own buildings, we need to own land, rather than depending on grants and handouts and stuff. Actually, if we own assets that are generating revenue, then we can really make this shit happen in a really scaling up kind of a way. The challenge with that is kind of pre-development finance. So something like Atmos, that's going to be like a 60, 70 million pound development. It's going to cost us about £600,000 to get up to getting the planning consent, but that's all at risk because we may not get the planning consent. You know, so we have some amazing kind of angels and funders who've come in and we're part of the way there. But I think the fairy godmother would recognize that it needs to be at risk. We need, as part of the divestment movement, you know, what you were saying earlier, it's about reinvestment. Actually, we need that money to come in and say, there is the most awesome opportunity here to shift energy, to shift development, to shift food, to shift all these things to the community scale. But that's not a level playing field. They need support. They need investment done in a different way. That's what I'd ask her for.
Thank you very much. Perfect, perfect conclusion. Thank you.
That was Rob Hopkins, founder of the Transition Towns Movement. Find out more about Rob in my show blog at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. And you are tuned to Radio EcoShock, the special on permaculture. I'm Alex Smith. We wrap with another speech from the latest International Permaculture Convergence in London, England last September. Rosemary Murrow started learning about permaculture in Australia in the early 1980s. She's founded branches in Cambodia, Vietnam, and many other places.
Well, goodness, that's been the theme of the conference in some ways, hasn't it? The good and the difficult. The really, really hard stuff to do. So, just to do a bit of a look at who we are and what we've done, we've been active for nearly 40 years. Very, very short time in life. And we've had some considerable achievements. And we've heard about a lot of those, haven't we? We've heard from Jonathan, we've heard about scaling up, we've heard about waves of permaculture from David. It's really been a rich smorgasbord in this conference. The thing that is on our side that even the Paris talks don't have is that major fact, we are on the side of life. Now that sounds simple, however so many of the things that we started with Vala, people are not on the side of life. And I think because we're on the side of life, we're actually garnishing a much greater force than we have we've been able to say. So I was looking at some of the elements and patterns in permaculture that have helped us achieve so well in such a time. 170 countries, perhaps a million graduates, I don't know, but it's a lot of people. So what I want to talk about is that everyone is part of the solution and no one's part of the problem. So let's look at some of the elements and processes that got us here today, that helped us achieve. Let's see if they're going to last us into the future And if not, what do we need? So let's build on also our earlier speakers from yesterday and today. Now, what have we got in permaculture? There's a need, there's a wanting. In some cases, there's a great grief. But most people, or maybe it'd be interesting to see if human happiness goes down with increased income and use of resources without caring for the earth. Be a very interesting correlation if it existed. It may not, but perhaps the more we use up, the less happier we are. Be good to look at people who live frugally and see if the happiness index goes up. We're going to look at our content, which has been entirely relevant for this new last wave of permaculture that David talked about from the 2002. And then we're going to look at our processes, what we do and why we're so radical. So I just like to take you back to need and how fast some people pick up permaculture. This was in Vietnam at Doi Moi in about 1985. Gosh, I crossed the centuries. I've grown old in permaculture. And so it's a buzz to see so many young ones. It's wonderful, so fabulous. So in late 1980s, when I went to Vietnam, they'd had 30 years of war and 30 million bomb craters. And most of the houses looked like this, and most of the people were as thin as a toothpick. Really, really thin. And the people were hungry, but satisfied that they had achieved some sort of peace in their country. It was a matter of rebuilding. And they knew they couldn't go back because they had 30 years of collectivisation, which, don't tell anyone, they hated collectivisation. Like, they liked the whole communist socialist government and Ho Chi Minh, but collectivisation, everyone moving out of their village where they lived for hundreds of years and their ancestors were buried, they loathed. They walked away from those brick houses, they left the doors floating in the wind and they went back to their villages. But 2 million men and women had died. The younger generation didn't know how to farm. They'd had 30 years of growing rice. 15 to 30 kilograms a month was the currency. They really needed to get started again. So there was a great need and they embraced permaculture. Next thing I want to look at is our content. I love the permaculture content. There's something profoundly beautiful and satisfying about the way it grows in depth and in breadth over the years as you teach it. And I'm easily distractible and bored, and if it weren't like that, I'd be out. What I loved was the permaculture, and in the 30 years I've been teaching it, I have seen it, the evidence come in. You know, when people first started talking about changing the climate, lots of people said, that's ridiculous. You know, 98% nitrogen, so much oxygen, so much moisture, you can't change the climate. In my life, I've seen it change. So I've seen the evidence come in for a permaculture. First of all, the global problems, which were brilliantly done up to date. And then see how permaculture can work with that. And so I have put here just some of the outcomes rather than the course curriculum. I think you know the course curriculum, but the outcomes, you know, if we work well with land and care of the earth, we are all our indices will be on accumulation of natural resources. We will look at how much water we've put back. We'll put at how much soil we've put back. How many species we've managed to save and build up. We will have measurements for the indices of restoration of ecosystems that become the most important thing in our economy. Because without that, no gelato society is going to exist. But we owe it to the future generations. We cannot go on like this. So restore and accumulate water, soil, forests. These must be our indices. Don't let us buy into the economists and the GDP and they won't believe us if we don't do this. They're going to have to believe us and we will have a better alternative, much better, and they'll say, tell us. So let's stay on for life. Let's be the people who love life, support it and want to see it grow. in terms of commerce, economy. We've been having a look at a whole range of things over these workshops, exciting possibilities, fabulous thinkers. Now, that's what permaculture's got, right? And then we've got the people, resilient and engaged. Now, when I started permaculture, the main objective was that everyone would build their own garden. And the first words that David and Bill used to talk about were permanence. And then gradually the word sustainability came in, but of course there's no sustainability unless you've got equal inputs and outputs, and we haven't got to equal inputs to match our outputs, so the word is, what would you call it, unbalanced or something? I don't know. You've got a better way of thinking about it. Okay, and then we're now talking about resilience in case of perturbation. So we've had some changes. We've gone from the individual now to communities, to towns, to cities, to bioregions as our unit, to our watersheds as our unit of work. And in a way, we've dropped that hyper-individuality that was in permaculture in the beginning, and we've really come to a new position where we see ourselves as citizens of groups and members of communities. And I love it. I don't know about you, but it feels so good just to be part of a group, and I think we've had that here today. So when we look at the permaculture curriculum or knowledge that was passed on, is the content going to serve us for a challenging future? Let's see. Can you see it's basically a branching pattern? Well, it's got the managing director up top, and then you've got the executive, and then you've got all the staff people who sign things and do things and say you can and you cannot. And finally, down the bottom, you've got someone else. Which are the people? Us, really. So what we find in that model and that process is that everything new has to go back up to the top. The board will consider that when it meets in a month. The director's not quite happy about it. We don't like that idea. Where did you go to school? What's your qualification? We have been free of that because we've had a different pattern. So let's look at this. What we did, if you don't mind a bit of history, is we started permaculture with Bill and David. And it started to spread because people went out and taught. People like me. I did a course with Robin Francis and I thought, oh, I'm going to have a go at this. And a year later, I was teaching. And I had 8 people in my first class. 2 were over 90. And they would sort of fall off the chair and wake up. One was a radical doctor. One spent a lot of time telling us, since as you grow up and give up singlets, you should also give up knickers. But they were an interesting first class. They came to permaculture. The next classes had something like 18, 20 people, and since then been teaching 2 PDCs a year, sometimes more, in the Blue Mountains where I live. Now, the point about the teachers is we have a long, long history. We teachers have gone to the marketplace, we've gone to the plazas, we've gone to the garages and the carports, we've gone to the villages, and we've taught the way Socrates taught in the marketplace. We've taught the way Jesus taught in the marketplace. Confucius. We have a history of taking our conviction and passion out to where the people are and saying, hey, would you like this? We think it's worthwhile. And so, who set our first curriculum and said you are qualified or not? I'm actually not qualified, I think, to be here today because I haven't been properly diplomed and certified, so it's a bit of an embarrassment. However, I also appreciate the increasing demand for quality of teachers and asking what works. We must find out what the good teachers do, and we will do that not by looking at their syllabus, not by giving them teacher training. We have to look at their graduates. We have to say, how good are the people coming out of that class? Yeah. So I would love, and I'm advocate, and I'm going to stand here and swear to you, I will defend any system that allows any person who wants to go out and teach permaculture anywhere, because it would be such a shame if we put the brakes on motivation and ability and passion. I will also defend the case it's in universities and TAFEs with a good curriculum to teach those others who appreciate formal education. But I stand with non-formal education of anyone who wants to get out there, do it. Make a film. Talk to your local society. It's yours. So the success of permaculture, see those? We'll have the yellow ones. Can you see the yellow ones? So the yellow ones are the teachers, and the success of teachers in permaculture can never be underestimated. Whether you made models and invited people to come and see, or whether you just took groups of people and gave them certificates. Now those teachers taught teachers. See the yellow spreading? Who taught teachers? And exponentially, permaculture's moved across the world, really, because of teachers who taught teachers. Now, they didn't all do it with certificates and courses, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Now, what happened then is some people were the designers and doers, and they did it. And without that, we teachers would have been lost. We had to go home and do it ourselves. We couldn't say, hey, you guys, do this. We can't show you what it looks like, and I haven't actually done it myself, but, you know, my friends say. And then we have the people who settled, and they explored topics. So we had the people who started GEN, the Global Ecological Eco-Village Network. We had the people who started Transition Towns, and we heard from Rob this morning. And they made little nodes that floated off and have become independent. So what we've got is all these progeny of permaculture, and you could name the food forest one. Today in America there's a huge conference on resilient communities, but we're the ones, didn't it? We know about resilient. They've taken it and run with it. So various people grab it and run through permaculture and feed it out there. Then we find economics is becoming a new node. So these people then create their own teachers and their own networks. It's sort of what Bala was saying, we're feeding into everywhere. There seems to be no place in the world that we haven't moved into. If you have a look at those, the schools network, they all have their own conferences. Urban Regeneration has their conferences. It's really creating progeny everywhere. The thing about our process is our pattern is our strength. If we had chosen a world body to control us, not support and resource us, and we haven't got one, we would be still back in Tasmania on the beach or in Daylesford, Victoria. It is because of our nodes and patterns and our freedom and our flexibility. And we must, over the future, stay open and adaptable to new ideas and areas. And you can see that networks accelerate, as our governments know. That's why they don't like networks much. People's movements, the web, you know. I mean, we've got PermaOccupy in Washington and in Barcelona. Well, the node there, easy, the link was the web. I wanted to talk to you about people doing new frontiers, except I'm not going to because I haven't got enough time. But have a look at Naomi Klein meeting up with Liz Bastian at a recent... Can you see what the conference is about? How do you feel about being part of that movement? Yeah. Right. Festival of Dangerous Ideas. And that's what we've been doing here in many of the workshops. Let's just go quickly to Cambodia, where I want to talk for a couple of minutes about infiltration. You know, a quarter of the population slaughtered by Pol Pot forces... disempowered, thin, hungry, overworked. When I went to Cambodia, it was a disaster. Newly formed government had departments like rural affairs, agriculture, women's affairs, who didn't know what to do. They'd never held those jobs. They had no brief. Their department didn't know. Their government didn't know. It was hopeless. And so when they invited me to do permaculture in Persat, suddenly they had a brief, and we had infiltrated into a government department. That then spread from Persat province to Kompong Chenang to Svadieng to Kandal to Kompot. So I trained the first trainers, and I trained them in permaculture. And then I went back and I monitored. I walked from village to village, monitoring, looking at food, decrease in waste, increase in money. Often just a dollar a week was enough to send a child to school, and a dollar a month would get you enough rice. Tiny increases in people's prosperity, but they could do it themselves. It became a people's movement. So the Department of Women Affairs went out to every village, and they stood there in the dirt and under houses, and they taught people how to do permaculture, but not until they'd done it themselves. So then the people learning had to come and look at the gardens of the trainers. And the whole thing was embedded into in-service training and salaries. Not a new NGO, not a model farm, just right through. Same thing happened in Uganda with Department of Agriculture at Rakai. Same thing happened with the Conso in southwest Ethiopia. It's happened through, to some extent, Permatil in East Timor. It's happened with Custom Gardens in Honiara and the Solomons. So what we do have is putting things in place that already existing and infiltrate and give people that knowledge, which is my second passion, is the right to good, reliable knowledge and evidence. People in the Solomon Islands really couldn't assess whether the ocean was rising or not, or whether they would get another tsunami. Terrible. So what we have done is try to get them information about their situation the way we've had here, but also information on how to move forward. I would like us now to just stop for a moment and think of those thousands, tens of thousands of permaculturists in Cambodia, in Vietnam, in Africa, in India, who can't be here today because they are the farmers on the ground practicing permaculture. If I could, I'd give every single one of them a certificate. They're absolutely worthy, and they are our silent majority of permaculturists. We are the tiny minority. Right? Just a picture. An orphanage in Cambodia, 300 children and 3 adults, 3 tiers deep, bunk beds, corrugated iron roof, bars on the windows. This is the play area. Permaculture there was taken partly by Jan Smart in Washington, and she invited me to go. Within 5 years, those children have an egg 3 times a week. They get bananas, they get papaya, they have full vegetables, and they love gardening. And when I arrived, they hated it. They had them all lined up, chipping with a big hoe, a heavy hoe, chipping the weeds. It has transformed. At the same time, the local Department of Agriculture said, we didn't know, when our Director General said you must do sustainability, we didn't know what sustainability was, but now we know. Our Burmese refugees, just doing it. A Lati in the Conso did the course in PDC, and the following Monday he was making seedlings and bringing 18 women every Monday down to his village to learn how to do permaculture, unpaid, unsung, unrecognised, but he loves it, because fundamentally we're happy, aren't we? So we are, all of us here, we all do so much more than we ever get paid for. We all belong to that gift economy, which is share surplus. We all, I think, are happier than having those huge amounts of, what was it, the GDP going up and up. I think we're on the happiness scale because what we do matters and it's meaningful to us. This book, I was concerned, I've always been concerned for resources, so I wrote the first book so people would have it at a level, because I've got a small sort of brain, and I had trouble reading Bill's book and keeping it together, so I wrote an easy one for me, and then it got published. And then the second one about teaching is for teachers who want good material, and it's thoroughly resourced. And this is for teaching permaculture teachers. And I wanted to do it because I wanted us to teach with a sense of care of people, not as curriculum, but as process. Treat people well. Listen to them. Listen to their opinions, hear what they've got to say. So that is free online to any of you here, I think, because I haven't looked. But it was crowdfunders who gave that. And it was crowdfunders who sent Paula Parnanen with John Battle-Abasi right now to Solomon Islands to help the people get ready because they'll have to move. It was the crowdfunding, which is part of a gift economy. Okay, right. Where to next? These are the places I think you are needed, and I think you're vitally needed. If our cities have 5 billion people by 2050, how good are we to offer cities fabulous resources? I don't think we're there. But permaculture shows we can be there and very quickly. We have more than 30 years to skill up and get good at cities. We've got lots of strategies. We've got lots of techniques. We can look to Hong Kong with their brilliant small-scale work. We can look to the roof gardens and the balcony farmers. We've got lots. We just need to put it together. Refugees. Well, look, I'd be stoked if we could develop a lovely way to work with people who are going into camps. I've worked in refugee camps in the past, and they see the need for permaculture. And yet, they're resourceful, they've got lives, they've got grateful to be there. They are some of the most wonderful people you'll ever meet. A friend of mine was in deep depression till he started to work with refugees, and he said, "This is great." Not because he was helping, but because of what they give to us. It's a great generosity of refugees. So Karen, who's in the last course, lives in Spain, and she said, "Oh, I want to go to developing countries and I want to do what you do." I said, "Well, the developing countries are coming here and so are the developed countries." And she said, "Well, I could go down to the coast, not far from our ecosystem, and see if people want to come up here and look and talk to us and share their skills." But go for it, Karen. You know, go for it. No qualification, no world body, no one's going to send you there. So how will we do it? I think you can answer these questions. Accelerate the succession. We've got one example from India. We had a fabulous example this morning for the UGEN, how to use mass media and mass movements and get it right. We have to move into the future with more visuals. That puts me out. We have to establish quality of trainees. We have to enable. Enable, adapt. Right. I've finished with this. In Kabul, where the war has gone now since 1978, there's a group of young people called the Afghan Peace Volunteers. And they're 50 people, mainly orphans and internal refugees, living in a little house. And they got in touch with me and said, "We want to learn permaculture." Now, they had no land and they had nothing to teach them and no books. And Kabul is being bombed. And so this is the rooftop of a girls' hostel, and we've been meeting when we can because there's no reliable web access on Skype. And a couple of them have actually died in the time since we started through landmines, bombs. They live probably in fear, like people in Syria, and they said, "We'll do a garden." And it's a beautiful permaculture garden. They said, "Enough war, our journey to peace. We want permaculture." They're seeking support. So 50 young Afghanis, partly permaculturalists, are saying they're going to stop war in the world. Takes some getting your head round. They haven't got anything, no families, no resources. They just believe it. It's enough. So if they can, you can. Thank you.
That was Rosemary Murrow. This speech was recorded at the 15th Annual International Permaculture Convergence in London, 2015. My thanks to Albert Bates for his talk, interview, and guidance in assembling this program. We'll have more to come next week. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and for caring about our world.